All right, let's make sure you're in fellowship and continue on here dealing with this section that we have regarding our warfare, our provision for that warfare, the necessity of our personal cooperation in that warfare, and not only on an individual but on a corporate basis if we are to be successful as a local church. It's not, again, what most people in America are into, and this is individuality all the way. The church is not about the individual, it's about the group. It's about the family, the body, and all of that. And we were here dealing with verse 13 here now. Take up, therefore, on account of this, because of this, of the enemies we face, all of that, take up the full armor of God. So that, purpose clause, you will be able to resist, to stand against him in the evil day. And having done everything, stand firm. 17 here, the prepositional phrase that follows, the evil or wicked day, should be understood to communicate the timing of the satanic demonic attack, which has resulted in a number of explanations as to how its phrase is to be understood. The first has an eschatological emphasis. That deals with matters of eschatology, the last things. The Greek word eschatos means last or final things, and has to do with the events that comprise or are germane to the resolution of the angelic conflict as God wraps this thing up. So some of them have taken it as an eschatological emphasis and is understood as a single day or a particular period of time of intense persecution and or tribulation, where satanic opposition reaches its peak just prior to the return of Christ. Well, I don't think there's any argument that just prior to the return of Christ, we live in the most evil time in history. The satanic opposition is maximized. The demonic opposition, these people have, these creatures have been doing this for decades, centuries, millennia now. And they've got their act together in terms of evil and all of that and how to drag believers down. I don't think there's any doubt that it's going to get bad. It's already gotten bad. I mean, there's mass murders every day, shootings, all the kinds of things. Our country supports all the things absolutely wrong in the world, moral evil, like homosexuality and all of this. That whole thing, I'm not going to call them gay. They're not happy. They're miserable. And guess what? They're miserable creatures that are ruining our society. And that's the reality of it. People don't want to deal with that. But this is a moral crime against God. And these are not our enemies, however. But again, our nation is seen to uphold God's enemies and promote them. And the victims take the back seat when it comes to prosecution of crimes. We're more concerned with the rights of the criminal, which is insane, but that's our country. Things are going to get bad. We know they're going to get bad. They're bad already. But I don't see this as just being that time, because number one, what value would that be if that's what he's referencing here? This last period of evil, what value is that to the Ephesians? They're 2,000 years removed from that. Doesn't have anything to do with them. So I think that because of this, these are, I think, general principles here that are valid for the entire church age. I don't think you should limit it to a particular period in history, because there are various times when evil will make some inroads and maximize, and then it kind of falls off, and then it will maximize again. There are various periods of evil times in history. Well, since Paul has used the same vocabulary, day and evil, earlier in Ephesians, some interpreters understand the evil day as being synonymous with the statement that the days are evil, which would then refer to the entire age between the first and second advent. He mentioned that back in 5:16, Ephesians 5:16, making the most of your time, because the days, as a general rule of thumb, are evil. They are poneros. That is active, malignant evil. They are actively engaged in evil. It's not just they sit around and think bad things. They do it. And the days are like this that we live in now.
Yeah.
And we're just like that. I see nothing new under the sun. It was that way in the first century A.D. A third view actually combines the first two and makes the latter part of the present age as the evil day, which will climax in a massive outbreak of evil at the end of this present evil age. Well, now that's true too. 2 Thessalonians talks about that with the rise of Antichrist and the advent of the day of the Lord. 2 Thessalonians 2:3-8. Let no one in any way deceive you. See, the Thessalonians had received a correspondence that was purportedly written by Paul, but it wasn't. It was a fraud that had been foisted upon them. And so they were confused about certain things. They got worried. One of the things, apparently, is that the day of the Lord has come. And this seems to be the kinds of teaching that Hymenaeus and Alexander, or Hymenaeus and Philetus, were engaged in. They upset people, telling them they're in the day of the Lord. Well, if you, and at this point in history, seriously, I don't know what Paul's understanding was. But this business of the day of the Lord is a tough nut to crack, I think. I didn't find it easy at any rate. Doesn't mean, might just be me. But I didn't find it easy identifying this because over history there have just been two positions. The day of the Lord begins with the rapture, or it begins with the second advent, one or the other. But it doesn't. And but again, how much of this did the Thessalonians or anybody that lived in the first century actually have to know? Now, Paul briefed them on certain things. So did Paul realize that the day of the Lord didn't begin until the midpoint of Daniel's 70th week? I don't know. But I know he recognized certain things. He said, let no one in any way deceive you, for it will not come unless the apostasy comes first. And apostasy has to do with both religious and civil falling away, opposition to, resistance to normal standards. And so it has both a political and a religious overtone to it, this term. It's used in both those ways in other Greek writings. So the apostasy comes first, the falling away. Well, this has always just been interpreted as a religious apostasy. But there's both things. The political apostasy is prophesied, say, in Psalm 2. The kings of the earth, why do the nations conspire? And the kings of the earth take their stand against the Lord and against His Messiah. Let us cast off their restraints and all that. That's political apostasy. And that the world's engaged in that big time. They're throwing off every restraint God has provided for humanity. We've tossed off marriage, we've tossed off volition, we've tossed off family, we've tossed off nationalism. The four divine institutions have been so brutally attacked that there's not much left of any of them. And so the nations are engaged in political apostasy. The church is engaged in religious apostasy, falling away from the truth and believing that God's going to just allow this to happen. Well, both occur at the end. And the man of lawlessness is revealed, the son of destruction. And that's a political aspect more in the first, at least his appearance, is going to be a far more political issue than it is a religious one. It will become a religious issue. A part of this apostasy involves the political casting off of God's will. Part of it involves the religious casting off of God's will. So who opposes and exalts himself above every so-called God or object of worship? He will tolerate no rivals. This is why he's going to destroy the Catholic Church. The Pope won't mean anything to him. Pope's just somebody that's in his way. Somebody that gets respect and all of that and admiration, and he's not going to tolerate that. So he's going to wipe out the Catholic Church at some point. We don't know when. I got to believe it comes pretty close to the destruction of the U.S. But it's done by the time he sets himself up and declares himself to be God in the temple. That's for sure. He's taken the Catholic Church out by then. So he was displaying himself as being God. Do you not remember that while I was with you, I was telling you these things? And you know what restrains him now, so that in his time he will be revealed. For the mystery of lawlessness is already at work. Only he who restrains, a reference to God the Holy Spirit, will do so until he is taken out of the way. A reference to the change of dispensations, the end of the church age, back to the age of Israel. the final 7 years there. And so he's, it certainly appears that the Holy Spirit is loosening his grip on morality and society in general. That this, he's going to eventually just let it go. But how much of evil, the only reason evil hasn't overrun us is the Holy Spirit still opposing it at some level. Or it would. It would rule over everything. So then he who restrains, and then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth. And the day of the Lord can't come before the Antichrist is on the planet. So that kind of rules out the rapture, because the Antichrist is on the planet as far as we know. He's resuscitated pretty early on. That the day of the Lord doesn't begin until he's on the planet, so it can't begin at the rapture because he's not on the planet at the rapture. We don't know what the gap will be there. How long will he be resurrected, that same day or next day or a week later? I don't know. We aren't really told that, but we don't need to know that to live the Christian life either. Doesn't matter exactly when the Antichrist is resuscitated. So the fourth view here now is that the evil day refers to critical points in the life of a believer, when the malicious, destructive, demonic attacks are particularly severe and or numerous. The times when Satan ratchets it up on you. And there are periods where it's not so bad. And then periods where it starts to get bad, and then periods where you just want to quit. And you're faced with, why not? What? Just cast in the towel. Just throw it in. Don't answer the bell. That's a boxing metaphor for those who don't get it. It's what happens in a boxing match if they don't want their fighter getting killed anymore. They throw in the towel. He doesn't answer the bell. That's their symbol that he's quit. Well, many believers have quit fighting in this fight. And that's another discouraging and depressing thing that you have to deal with. Watching people you love act like idiots. That's sad. I don't enjoy that one bit. People that you've cared for, people that you've poured your life out for, made tons of applications towards them, and they won't lift their finger for God's plan. That's disgusting to me. But that's one of the depressing things we have to face as positive believers. People who at one time were positive and who knew better, and then they run away from the faith, and then they want to drag others down with them. They're not content just to go. They got to run their mouths too and justify their behavior. Well, I'm not fooled by it, neither should you be. Well, 18, the actual Greek construction is helpful here in verse. When we have the evil day, that you wouldn't know the Greek that was behind that from the English construction. But it is important. So it's helpful here in that, and I left out the words, the adjective. That might have been helpful to identify what stands after the noun. In that the adjective stands after the noun and the definite article is repeated. This is classified as the restrictive attributive construction. And Kaufman, point A, points out that this construction is more emphatic than other adjectival constructions and implies that there are days that are not necessarily as evil. Well, and again, that's why I take this in this way, that you have days that may not be as evil. The attacks may not be as severe. Depends on your situation. And additionally, the view that the entire age is evil, while correct, that's true, does not address the difference between the plural days, the days are evil, and the singular, very emphatic construction, the evil day, the evil one, which is very much a Hebraism. That's the way the Hebrews wrote. The noun, the adjective would follow the noun, and oftentimes with the article repeated. So lastly, the use of the definite article must be considered, which suggests a single day or a day with some particular significance. He doesn't say an evil day like it could occur, but it's a specific type of evil day. You have to recognize, I think, that some days, again, aren't as bad. Other days, it's just all you can do to get through them. And that's why we rely on the fellowship of other people. Pick up the phone, call somebody, go eat with somebody, say, hey, I'm struggling. But nobody wants to show weakness. I get it. That's part of human nature. That's part of the ego. You don't want to show weakness. It's too difficult. I need help. Well, we should be willing to do that. That's part of humility. Before honor comes humility. And you're going to have to humble yourself. We all do. And just say, hey, I'm not handling this very well. I'm under the gun here. Pray for me. And that's your opportunity then to apply to encourage them. So thus, point 19, the evil day refers to specific days in a believer's life when demonic forces are marshaled against him. The attacks are particularly numerous and or intense, and the temptation to abandon the fight is especially strong. Everybody fights this. I've had believers tell me, well, I'm struggling, I get depressed. Who doesn't? How the hell do you live in this world and not be a little depressed? This is part of the problem with society. All of society is depressed. They handle it with Prozac and Wellbutrin and other things, whatever the new ones are. I can't keep up with the antidepressants. I may not be depressed enough. Maybe I'm not. I mean, I know what depression is. I know what happens. I've been through it. I go through it. Been through it in the last week. You just wonder, what's the point? You just want to throw up your hands and quit. And then you have part of the encouragement comes from other positive believers who you know are fighting the same fight. They're fighting it as hard as you are. Others aren't fighting at all. Those are the discouraging, depressing ones. Well, this view acknowledges that there are times when things are not overly difficult in the warfare. God does provide respite from the fight. If he didn't, we'd be done in. I mean, you can only live under so much stress. And let's face it, this world is designed to stress you out all the time. Information overload, constantly keeping your mind occupied with things that have nothing to do with God. And some of these things are fine in their place. They're not all sinful. I watch people and, I saw say the other day, back to full capacity, all the seats for the Bucks games are all sold out. Oh, darn it. Bummer for me. Why are they all sold out? Because people will go up there. They will start at 8 or 9 in the morning, tailgate for 3 or 4 hours, go to the game, which lasts 3 to 4 hours, and then the after party, another 3 or 4 hours, and they'll blow a whole day on nothing that has anything to do with the truth, just to occupy themselves, to keep people occupied. This is part of Satan's deal. Keep their minds moving on 90 different things, just as long as it's not the truth. I don't care what it is. It could be good, bad, harmful, could be malicious, doesn't matter. Just anything that isn't the truth. And keep them occupied, keep them busy, keep them on overload. And so how to handle all of this, the attacks and all, the stress that comes with all of this. This is why these things are so critical, these metaphorical weapons that we have. Well, so God provides respite from the fight, but the believer, that should be the believer, should never be lulled into a false sense of security. Since the battles are not over, they're going to be ongoing. You may have a victory here and there, and that's good. We should have some. And that's an encouragement. That from time to time, hey, I was able to withstand the devil. But, and what you see, say, sort of in the broad light of day when you are up and normally functioning and all of that, but when you're laying awake at bed at night at 3 or 4 in the morning and all the pressures of the world are on your shoulders, you find, it's easy to get discouraged and depressed. And believe me, those are the times when you need every ounce of doctrine you got and to rigorously think your way through it. Or you can say, well, I'm getting tired, this is getting old, I'm going to quit. So, Father, I'm not interested in your plan anymore. I'm going to go do my own thing. And call it God's will, I guess. That's what a lot of people do. They do their own thing, call it God's will, and I'm supposed to be dumb enough to believe that. But I'm not. And you shouldn't be either. Well, 21, the conjunction chi here connects the final portion of verse 13 with the initial purpose clause. So that you will be able. With the aorist infinitive of histemi. Functioning as the complement of the verb be able. You will be able to stand once you do this. Having done everything here, you will be able to stand firm. That's kind of a little bit of a promise in here. You will have the capability of standing firm if you follow these instructions and rigorously apply this. So this is parallel to the first clause and provides the second specific purpose in taking up or putting on the full armor of God. And that's being able to stand. You're able to resist and you're going to be able to stay on your feet. You're not going to get knocked for a loop in the Christian life, in the conflict. There is an intervening phrase composed of an aorist participle and the anarthrous adjective hapas. Which is an intensive form of the adjective pas, every. And 24, this term denotes the totality of anything. And when used of people, it has the sense of everyone. The neuter form here has the sense of all things or everything. I think I pointed that out in the exegesis that it is an having done all things, it's an accusative neuter plural. But again, everything, it means the totality of it all. That's why they didn't translate it like a true plural. Everything is comprised of a bunch of particulars. So in this context, it refers to everything that pertains to the matter of spiritual preparedness for the battle. The onslaught of Satan or his wicked forces. So 26, the verb Paul uses is katergazomai, which means to bring about a result by means of doing something, to achieve or accomplish something. And having achieved or accomplished, in other words, once you've done everything here, put on every piece and you're ready, you're going to be able to stand firm. If you followed this and follow his instructions, you are going to have success. And this is a promise in here. So although some seek to give this verb the sense of overpowering or subduing, which is designed to convey the idea that victory has been achieved, there is no such justification for that translation. It should be rendered as it has been in the New American Standard Version, which indicates that the believer has made all the necessary preparations for the battle. And that begins back in verse 10, of course, to strengthen yourself in the Lord. That's where it's got to start. You've got to be prepared before you even start putting on your weapons and your armor and your equipment. You have to be mentally prepared. And then, see, it should, although someone would classify this as a participle of means or cause, because you have done everything, you will be able to stand. It's just as simple and makes just perfect sense to leave it. The temporal understanding is the best. And that's normally what the aorist participle represents, is action prior to the main verb. And so if you're going to stand after you have done everything, you will be able to stand. You'll be able to stay on your feet in the angelic conflict. Well, 27, this verb also emphasizes that while God provides the believer all he needs to be victorious in the angelic conflict, each soldier must spend the proper time and exert the necessary effort to be prepared for battles with the enemies. And Jesus has warned us, a man's enemies will be those of his own household. Negative volition within the household is going to be one of your enemies. That's something that has to be addressed and dealt with. You can't keep harboring God's enemies indefinitely and think that God's going to say, oh, that's okay, we're in a warfare here, but you can put the enemy up. You know what happens in a warfare if you get caught harboring the enemy? You're killed. They don't try you, they kill you. It's viewed as treasonous. It's treasonous to harbor negative volition and call it okay. It's treasonous to the warfare effort we fight. Well, 28, Paul has made it clear that the believer will face organized and intense attacks at various points in the Christian life. These times are of more intense conflict, are certainly in harmony with the evil age in which we live. We've got general evil around us all the time, but it specifically is getting more and more and more concentrated and more ridiculous, to where people don't even think about things anymore. I just saw the Supreme Court upheld Obamacare the other day. And what part of our Constitution gives the government the right to mandate anybody has to buy anything? What are they going to tell us next? We all got to get Teslas? That's what they'd love to, and Elon would love that too. Because the government's been propping Tesla up since day one. This is a part of this infrastructure deal. A lot of it's going to Tesla. Oh, sure. Well, we're going to mandate health care. We're going to mandate electric vehicles. Pretty soon, you won't be able to use electricity. So the government doesn't have the right. There's nothing in the constitutional about mandating universal health care. But this is the evil that is just accepted. And now our Supreme Court, who's supposed to be tilted somewhat towards the right, comes up with the stupidest decision I've ever heard in my life. There's no justification for this. So, we got general evil all the time. Well, certain evil keeps being foisted on us. Now, if you'll profit from Obamacare, I did okay under Obamacare. I at least had insurance. But is it constitutional? No, absolutely not. And 29, because of this reality, the soldier must make it his priority to cultivate faithfulness to the Lord. growing in his grace and knowledge, being diligent to appropriate the resources God provides, being vigilant with regard to the schemes of Satan, and most importantly, standing with his fellow soldiers. This business of you're fighting the Christian fight by yourself is just flat wrong. You've missed the point of Christianity, if that's what you think. And so I saw this little visual and I thought it helped, so I downloaded it, and there you go. And it's just a little visual, got off the internet. And we're going to see all of these things will come up. The first one we start with actually is the belt of truth. That's the first thing. And this is, again, we'll see, deal with that. But you got the shoes, the appropriate footwear to keep yourself stable in the conflict. The truth, which, by the way, is used to gird up your loins so that you can fight unimpeded. That was the deal, to make movement easier. And that was always done prior to engaging. You girded up your loins. They would tuck their excess robes and all of that into the sides of this. And they could also hang other weapons and things on it. But it was really used to make you more mobile. Then you have the shield of faith. And this is the big shield. And this picture is good because there were two Roman shields. And this is the big broad shield of faith. It's the larger of the two. They had a smaller, more mobile, compact one, but it was round. And it didn't protect. This shield could actually protect the whole body, as we'll see. Then the sword, we're going to get that, the offensive weapon, the sword of the Spirit, and the breastplate of righteousness, and the helmet of salvation. Helmet, obviously, is designed to protect the mind. Breastplate protects the heart and the inner organs. The necessary organs, or you'll die. You need those. So that's kind of what we're looking at in terms of a visual look at this. But again, as we point out, this is metaphorical. It's not literal. Let me just start again here because I'm about halfway through there. No. Okay, good. Overhead. There you go. Okay. Now verse 14. Once again, you haven't got this standing business down yet. We're going to repeat it for you. And if you haven't caught it the first few times. Stand firm, therefore. Inferential conjunction, un. The imperative again. Aorist imperative of histemi. H-I-S-T-E-M-I. And this is a good one to point out. That this can't be a once and for all deal. That when you go out into a conflict, you're going to have to stand your ground. Once the conflict is over, you're free to vacate. But then you got to, then once the conflict starts up again, you got to stand your ground again. And so this has to be done repeatedly. You have to be into this for the long haul. To be willing to stand your ground spiritually and not compromise. When everything around us, the church, the lukewarm church is so loaded with compromise. Doctrinal churches are loaded with compromise in certain ways. That's sad. Shouldn't be. But some of them I've seen, they're loaded with compromise. And we don't have to compromise with this stuff. So stand, inferential conjunction, un, therefore. Draws here a conclusion, stand. Having a belt strapped around the waist with truth. It's hard to... The literal translation of this is what you've got in the New American Standard. Having girded your loins with truth. But having girded your loins doesn't say anything about the belt. And that's what it is actually. But they would have understood this certainly within Paul's day. That wouldn't have been any problem. So having a belt strapped around your waist here is perizonumi is our verb. And it's actually an aorist middle participle. So in other words, the middle indicates your personal involvement in this. Perizonumi. Perizonumi. Six times its word. This means to put a belt or sash around the body. And again, the aorist participle would precede the action of this verb. You put this on before you attempt to take your stand. So having a belt strapped is kind of around the waist. That's the whole perizonumi idea here. But again, we tend to use a belt around our waist. They tend to use it a little lower. And that's why it's called loins, because it could be down even around the thigh or just above the thigh. So, and then you have this noun, accusative feminine singular, having a belt strapped around the waist, is osphus. O-S-P-H-U-S. With the definite article, feminine, the place where the belt is worn, the loins or the waist. I just say waist because that's what the modern culture is familiar with. That's where we would put it. Just recognize they did it slightly differently. So having a belt strapped around your waist, of you all, once again, plural, not singular, commands every soldier here to fulfill this. Everyone in the unit, you all sue. Having a belt strapped around the waist with truth. You got a couple of choices here, an instrumental of means, a belt strapped by means of truth. I don't think that was it. An instrumental here of material that you use the truth, and so it would be translated with truth, which is probably closer here. A belt that's made from truth. That truth is the key element here. The belt itself is truth. By means of or with truth. Aletheia. A-L-E-T-H-E-I-A. This is truth, objective reality. As opposed to, say, what is false, what are lies, what are myths, all the things that aren't truth that people can offer. But this is the key element here. The truth is what kind of holds things together. And in that case, the truth, the belt, was where you held in your robes and you were prepared for the fight, geared up for it. Having the belt around the waist with truth and chi connective, and having put on, again, an aorist middle participle, emphasizing the believer's responsibility that he has to do this, having put on yourselves, a plural, again, all of these are plurals through here, the breastplate of righteousness. Definite article, pardon me, ho, thorax. T-H-O-R-A-X. Guess what word we get from this? Thorax. That one just translates right over into the English, or transliterates. Five times. This means breastplate. The thorax is the breast of the person. And this means the covering for it. The covering for the chest. A breastplate of righteousness. Definite article with the abstract noun dikaiosune. D-I-K-A-I-O-S-U-N-E. Sune nouns are generally abstract. Now, what is righteousness? Well, righteousness is being right. The root tells you what it is. It has to do with being right. Now, what is right? Right is what God says it is. If God says it's right, it's right. Other things aren't right. It doesn't matter if a million people say, let a million men be liars and God be truthful. Because many people can say something's right that's flat out wrong. It's just absolutely wrong. But here is a breastplate of righteousness, and this is a genitive of apposition. In other words, the breastplate itself is righteousness. This is how these metaphors work out. These are qualities rather than actual pieces of armor. But why does righteousness protect your heart? Well, we'll see. But it does. And that's what's important. And you got people that aren't experientially engaging in righteous living. Well, guess what? They don't have their breastplate on. And if I'm a very smart soldier and I'm in a warfare against you and you're not wearing the breastplate, I know where I'm shooting. You know, it's really simple. I was watching one of those deals the other day on Yellowstone. And they were going ready to go after some guys that had committed some violent crimes and all of that. And they were geared up, the law enforcement. And he said this guy was taking, I don't know, a pistol or something. And he was pulled out a pistol rather than a bigger gun. He said that pistol will never penetrate their body armor. He said, I'm not aiming for the body. I'm going to take their heads off. They don't have anything protecting them. And also I can shoot better with this. If you see an area of weakness, why would you strike at the area of strength? That doesn't make any sense. No, they're wearing body armor. You're not going to pierce that. Oh, okay. Well, then I'll shoot them in the eyes. That'll stop them. Just look for the whites of their eyes. All right. Well, point one here. Paul has been discussing the matter of being strong in the strength of the Lord. which has been explained in terms, first you have to do it, but then he goes right immediately into this whole armor thing. So both have to be, you know, they work together. If you got a soldier that never works out and it's a 98-pound weakling and you put the armor, if you remember that story where they tried to put Saul's armor on David, who was just a teenager at the time. And well, David couldn't move. you have to be strong. This is the whole thing, is the preparation initial to putting the armor on. Well, two, he has been discussing the matter of putting on that armor in a general way. But with verse 14, Paul begins to provide specifics about the various pieces of equipment that are necessary if the believer is to withstand the cunning schemes of the devil and his spiritual forces. This section, which extends from verse 14 all the way down through verse 20, is the last of the 8 long sentences in this book. It consists of 113 words and is divided into 2 parts by 2 aorist imperatives. Verse 14, to stand, and then the next imperative is actually not seen until verse 17. Take, there you have another imperative. But these are the 2 big main verbs in all of this. There's other associated verbs too, but these are the 2 big main ones. So Paul uses an extended metaphor that has often been understood to be based on the attire of a Roman soldier prepared for battle. Now, I've heard these, you read commentaries, and I've heard all of this before. I even, you know, back when I was a fundy, a Southern Baptist. I said, well, Paul's sitting there, and he's looking at a Roman soldier that's armed for battle every day because he's chained to it. First, that's not right. Why would the Roman soldier be wearing all his armor when he's there guarding Paul? And certainly one man was not a threat to a Roman soldier. Now, he would have probably had his sword with him, I presume, as any guard would. But does he need a breastplate and a helmet to guard Paul and proper shoes? I think he pretty well has it under control. So Paul wasn't staring at these guys all the time, and this is where he got it from. But he had seen it often enough. You had seen, if you were living in the first century and you were in and around Israel, you'd seen Roman soldiers. You would be familiar with them. And Paul, of course, was more international than that. He didn't just live in and around Israel. I mean, he came from Tarsus, which was a big deal city during that time. And he'd been in many of these other places. So he'd seen all this. And certainly, here by the time he's in Rome, he's seen armed soldiers. But now, again, I don't think he's standing there looking at a fully equipped soldier every day. But that's what I was taught. And I thought, oh, well, that makes sense. No, I didn't. Well, other interpreters believe here that Paul is, the language he uses is not specifically drawn from the equipment of the Roman soldier, but from passages in Isaiah that deal with the Messiah as a warrior. I mentioned this earlier in the first session, Isaiah chapter 11. And clearly the language here is referential to Messiah. A shoot will spring from the stem of Jesse, and a branch from his roots will bear fruit. Well, this indicates that historically Messiah has to come from a particular lineage. He had to be of a particular tribe. In fact, he had to be of the tribe of Judah, which is, again, one of the issues you face when you recognize that Messiah transcends all things. Because you get into Hebrews, for instance, the book of Hebrews, and it said, how can the Messiah be a priest? Because all the priests had to come from the tribe of Levi. And if had he been an earthly priest, he couldn't have been a priest. But he's a heavenly priest, which is different. The rules are different, apparently. The lion of the tribe of Judah is not only prophet and priest, he's king. He occupies many offices, Messiah and all that. So, but he had to come from a, and again, when you go in that book, Evidence That Demands a Verdict, I believe Josh McDowell spent some time calculating out the odds of all these individual little prophecies. That he has to come from Jesse. Now that's David's dad. That he had to come from that specific family. And then, you know, he had to be of a particular tribe, had to come be born in a specific place, Bethlehem. Had to be born in Bethlehem. And there's all these particulars about the Messiah, all these Old Testament prophecies, and you look at them. And they say, you know, the odds of this being true in any one human being are astronomical. If people, but see, this is why the lottery's successful. People can't do math. And you see it when they start calculating odds. What are the odds? They couldn't calculate them if you told them how to. But the odds are just astronomical that this would be one guy. And the Spirit of the Lord will rest on him. In verse 3, he will take delight. He will delight in the fear of the Lord. And he will not judge by what his eyes see, nor make a decision by what his ears hear. But with righteousness he will judge the poor, and decide with fairness for the afflicted of the earth. See, there's coming a time when all this is going to be made right. It's all going to be just. And all the people that have been abusive and run over people and destroyed them and destroyed the planet, God, they'll have to answer to God for all this, for all their evil they've done to people. Also verse 6, verse 5 here, also righteousness will be the belt about his loins. Well, there it's obviously not the same thing, because Paul says truth, for instance. But he uses similar language, and faithfulness will be the belt around his waist. Okay, that's applied to Messiah. Okay, so maybe he's looking at that passage and saying, hey, this is similar to what I've got here. But these are the things Messiah wears. This is his equipment. And obviously, our equipment's related to it, but he doesn't give us, as it were, all his equipment. He's got to have it. Taking the metaphor. And then 52, Isaiah 52, verse 7. How lovely on the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news, who announces peace and brings good news of happiness, who announces salvation and says to Zion, your God reigns. Well, obviously in the context here, this is not a Christian warrior, because this is a pre-Christian. First, this is the age of Israel. And he's talking in very general terms here, not specifics, about anyone. Just as a general rule. And in fact, this verse is a messianic verse as well, because he was the premier example of bringing good news. There was never any better news brought than what he brought. That was it. And also 59:17, the last one. There the footwear, though, is the good news. 59:17. Actually, it begins the thought, and he saw that there was no man, verse 16. And this was to provide salvation, and he was astonished there was no one to intercede. Then his own arm brought salvation to him, and his righteousness upheld him. He put on righteousness like a breastplate. Well, that's obviously the very language we have in Ephesians. There's no doubt. And a helmet of salvation on his head. Whoops, that sounds like Ephesians 2. And he put on garments of vengeance. Uh-oh, we don't have any of that. We're not allowed to take vengeance. So that breaks down really quick. You know, it would be kind of nice if God would let us, but we can't. He's going to take care of this. We faith rest it that God will take care of the evil out there. We just have to oppose it and stand against it. By our actions, by our lifestyle, with our words, we oppose this stuff. We do not just lay down and roll over and act like it's all okay because the cosmos says it's okay. But some of the language here, you can see why interpreters say, well, he's borrowing from this language. Oh, I don't doubt that he's borrowing from it. But these are all, once again, he's talking about God and Messiah here, putting on the breastplate, not believers. This is Messiah does this. So there is certainly some similarity. There's no doubt about it. Between the concepts found in Isaiah, Paul quotes parts of verses. But all the metaphorical equipment is not mentioned in Isaiah, for one thing, which does suggest that Paul had current military equipment in mind as well. And it may well be that Paul uses a blend of Old Testament citations and the equipment of the Roman soldier in order to make his points with regard to the preparation that is necessary for the spiritual warfare in which the believer is to be engaged. And again, whether believers are engaged in this and fighting the good fights up for grabs. But this is what they're supposed to be doing. That much I do know. That much is clear. So 8, Paul begins verse 14 with the inferential conjunction un, which is designed to introduce an implication from what he has been saying. And 9, since the church has very powerful, cunning, supernatural opponents. And since God has provided the necessary resources to withstand their malicious attacks, believers should prepare to stand the spiritual ground God has provided. And to stand for the principles of the truth in light of people rejecting them, ridiculing them, advocating just the opposite, and that's what most of the cosmos does. They advocate just for the opposite of the truth. That's what they want. I'll be glad when we get rid of all these holidays and parades. We glorify these people. Pride Day, yeah, pride. What are you proud of? They glory in their shame. And some people apparently take it on their own, because I saw a deal where apparently some guy drove right into a crowd of them and killed one of them. We shouldn't do that. We might applaud it, but we shouldn't do it. We shouldn't applaud it because it's lawless. But the fact is, these people are gross, and they are a reflection of what our society has become. And this is what we stand against and fight against. And that's just purely in the physical realm of sexuality. But everything's under attack. Again, part of all of this is designed to destroy a marriage and family. And it's succeeded. Because one thing you can say about queers, they can't reproduce. They have to recruit. That's the only way they can expand their numbers, is recruiting. Because they're not going to reproduce. Can't do it. It's against nature. The Bible's really plain on this. So we got these forces. They're going to be, they're coming. You've got to be ready to stand your ground. And that means that we stand against all this stuff. We stand against weak believers who won't pay the price. I'm opposed to them. If you don't want to pay the price for God's plan, you don't think very much of God. And you don't think very much of His Son who died in your behalf. And that's kind of pathetic. People don't want to stop and think about that. This has to do with how I'm related to Jesus Christ. You can blame the church, you can blame the pastor, you can blame the deacons, you can blame anybody. But really what it boils down to is your relationship with God Himself. And it's not correct for those people who won't fight this fight. So we have these opponents. Well, we're going to have to be prepared, and we're going to have to stand our ground against them. 10, the imperative of the verb histemi is used to indicate the posture of a soldier about to engage in combat. He is to maintain his position, resist his enemy, and prevail over him. The fact that the verb stand is used also suggests that the soldier has been stationed in a particular place, which is he is to occupy and defend. And this gets into the matter of God's directive, geographic will. Where does God want me? And I've listened to a bunch of people, and I've fallen for it. Stupid me. I've been blindsided by people. When they say, oh, I want the truth. I just want the truth. I want the truth at a high level as I can get it. And many people have said that to me. Most of them aren't on doctrine anymore. So people can give lip service to the truth all day long. But the ones that are fighting the fight, that's the issue. Those are the ones we support. People in their talk about how they love the Lord and they're oriented, I've heard it all. And I've watched them walk away from the truth and justify it in the name of, I don't know what. I don't want to know how they justify their negative volition. I'm not interested in that. All I know is it's wrong, however they justify it. So you've got a position as a believer in this local church. You've got a position to fulfill. You've got a place you're supposed to be. Easily enough, when we have Bible class, when we assemble, that's where you're supposed to be. That's the first place. But then there's other things in your life applying towards other believers and applying to the church at large that you're expected to do as a soldier. You're not just there to just take up space. However, here, the nature of the believer's enemies should inform the reader that this is not going to be a single battle, but will involve an intermittent series of attacks designed to displace, neutralize, or even better, to destroy the Christian soldier. To wipe him out. Now, he won't wipe you out by killing you. That takes you out of the conflict. He wants you as a weapon. He wants to use you to demoralize other believers and to get them to want to throw in the towel. Because one of the most discouraging things in the world is people that won't stand their ground and fight the Christian fight. This is discouraging. And it demoralizes the rest of the troops. This is part of the problem. Well, again, this isn't going to be a single battle. And they're coming after you, and the goal is destruction. The thief comes only to rob and to kill and to destroy, to steal. What's he stealing from people? He's stealing their very lives from them. Do you think reversionists actually are living? They're alive, but they're living, but they're dead. Just like the Mary Widow syndrome. They're living while dead. Conflict, you might say. That contradiction. They're alive, but they're dead. And then most people aren't actually living. They don't have any capacity for life. They just trudge through it and try to get to the end of it. And then at the end, they're screaming bloody murder that they want God's help. When they come face to face with death, all of a sudden everybody wants to get oriented. Well, better get oriented before you come face to face with death. It's going to be too late then. So in this section here, Paul will provide details regarding the six main pieces of a soldier's equipment, which include the belt, the breastplate, the boots, the shield, the helmet, and the sword. And 14, he uses each piece of equipment to portray some virtue, like truth, righteousness, or faith. Again, these are intangibles, but things that are critical to living the Christian life. To acknowledge the importance of the gospel to the soldier's stability. To refer to some spiritual reality, like salvation. And to include the single offensive weapon, the sword of the Spirit. But that's the one single offensive weapon we've got, which is the statements of God, or statement of God, the pronouncements God has made. So 15, Paul introduces the first four items in God's panoply using a series of aorist participles, which should be understood in the regard to their normal temporal relationship with the main verb. In other words, the believer must complete these actions prior to taking his stand. Taking your stand is the last thing you do. You do your workout first. You get strong in the Lord and in the power of His might. Then you put on your soldiering equipment, your warfare equipment, and then you take your stand. But you have to do this in a particular order if you're going to be successful. It's dumb to take your stand again as a 98-pound weakling that can't lift the sword. Doesn't do you any good. It's dumb to take your stand. Oh, I've worked out. I'm a massive specimen of humanity. But I forgot my weapons and my defensive weaponry. You're going to die. I don't care how good a shape you're in. Swords are going to beat fists. Like you brought a fist to a sword fight. Like bringing a knife to a gunfight. Not very smart. So again, the first four here again. So we'll see this. Having put on, having girded your loins with truth, having put on the breastplate, having shod your feet. There. Although some interpreters want to categorize these participles as causal, and then they would translate this, take your stand because you have done these things. Well, I don't see any real causal relationship here. I see that this is a command, and by extension, these are have somewhat of imperatival force, but you got to do them first. So here, I don't see these as causal at all, and some as the means by which the believer can stand, and some as imperatives. Well, there is imperatival force to them, no doubt, because you got to put them all on. It's take your stand, but you got to do this first, and that is to put on your belt, put on your breastplate, put on your shoes. Those you have to do first. So the simplest view here, antecedent action, makes good sense. And when the simplest view, Occam's razor, the simplest view is often the right view. The easiest explanation, the most natural explanation, is often the best view, explanation. There's no point in complicating this with these participles, I don't think. They want to, but I don't think there's any reason to. Well, 17, the first item in the metaphorical armor deals with the idea of a belt around the waist that was used particularly by soldiers and athletes to tie up their flowing garments around the hips or waist. This was designed to provide them greater freedom of movement and so that they would be prepared. I mean, if you're dealing in a conflict, in a fight, you've got to be mobile at some level. You're trying to stand your ground, but that doesn't mean you stand exactly still. You have to have a good foothold, certainly, to do all that. And we'll see that you had to have your garments in such a way that they didn't impede you That's this whole thing with the breast, or not the breastplate, rather, but the girding your loins with truth. The belt of truth around your waist that you use to help get yourself ready for the fight. Knowing that the fight is coming. But how critical are we going to see is truth to all of this? This is where he starts. And I got to believe he starts with truth for a reason here. Because this is one of the fundamental things that's so critical to the entire Christian life and all your experience. Okay, well, our time is gone. We're going to have to go ahead and stop there today. We'll continue here on Tuesday with working here on verse 14. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for the opportunity to fellowship in the things of your word. We pray that this information would sanctify to our souls so that we continue to stand our ground, fight the good spiritual fight, and hear well done at the end of our Christian experience. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.